Hello and welcome to The Deep Dive Perspective, a show in which we try to platform those people who are often deplatformed, censored, cancelled, whatever you want to call it, and to get to the bottom of issues which are often shrugged off or swept aside as conspiracy theory. I don't like that word. Conspiracy theory is an entire phrase built by the CIA in order to do the very thing that people do, which is to end up cancelling people and stopping them research issues to the root causes and to get to the bottom of things. We don't do that here. This show is specifically geared towards investigating and using old investigative journalistic techniques of actually trying to get to truth, actually finding the real evidence and presenting it for you to make your own mind up. We're obviously here countering what legacy media has begun to do, which is to start giving you narratives which are far too close to what corporations and what the actual state, whichever state it may be, want them to. This is our fundamental function. We need you to like, share, and subscribe to this channel in order that we can do the work that journalists should be doing, which is bringing you narratives which allow you to really get to the truth. And today's topic really focuses on something which touches the lives of everybody in the world. It's one of those international issues which constantly gets ignored again by that same mainstream media for a reason, which we'll discuss, of course, as the show goes on. But what we're really looking at is the theft of the commons. The idea of the commons belonging to humanity, belonging to the people, or belonging to a particular group of people within a nation, state, very much a construct of recent times, is something which we need to really, first of all, understand the parameters of. What is the notion of theft of commons? How does Agenda 2030, how does the United Nations, and how do the global corporations play a part in the theft of the commons? What does it entail in terms of how you lose out through this concept? We're going to go into a deep dive today on this whole issue of theft of commons, and I've got nobody better to navigate me on this, but Tony Gosling, former BBC journalist, a land rights activist in his heyday, and somebody who actually still subscribes to the old school investigative journalism that I was talking about. Welcome to the show, Tony.
Hi, Mohsin. Nice to see you. Still in my heyday, actually. Look. Before we talk about the tragedy of the commons, I'd just like to say a little thing about this term conspiracy theory. Mark Lane and David Attlee Phillips, because the CIA invented this term because someone called Mark Lane, as a lawyer, was getting to the truth about who'd killed JFK in 1963. And that was the CIA. David Attlee Phillips was the controller of the operation. He brought the Chicago Mafia down to Dallas. There was a former sniper from the 82nd Airborne Division by the name of James Files, who was on the grassy knoll. There were two other shooters who both missed. They were in the Dowtech building, also from the Chicago Mafia. And these facts are there. Actually, Files is still alive. And this, I think, is what's going to be. But the point is, this is why they use this term conspiracy, to try and stop anyone getting to the truth about the JFK assassination. So I've just told you what I believe happened, and the evidence is very strong that this is what, because the Chicago Mafia had their hitmen. If someone wanted to hire a hitman internally in the United States, it was very easy for the CIA to do that through them. But anyway, you wanted to talk about the tragedy of the commons. This is a book, The Tragedy of the Commons. The idea is to turn it into a tragedy. It wasn't a tragedy, it was a theft. Certainly in this country, which I'm most familiar with, over the centuries, we started off with the original settlement of land in villages around Britain.
Yes.
In medieval times, something called the open field system. Every village, and this is a feudal system really, brought in by the Normans. You had a small number of people living in the village, and it was basically like giant allotments. You had no fertilizers in those days, so you had to use what's called crop rotation. So you could only grow in a field for 1 or 2 years, and then you have to leave it fallow for a year. This was a very inefficient system. apparently. And so somebody around the Elizabethan era decided, look, we don't need all these people on this land. We can turn a lot of it over to sheep and just put sheep on there. And all these people can come and work in the factory in the town. And that's why Britain was probably the first country in the world to make a conscious decision to go for mass urbanisation and do what China has done more recently, to bring people from the countryside to work in factories and in the cities here. And so that's the history of the enclosures, which really was sped up by the English Civil War. Massive amount of enclosure in Britain, where land was then privatised. The people were turfed out of their houses. A lot of the cottages were in fact, many of the big manor houses you see around Britain were built in the 18th century on the money made from enclosure of land. So this was a form of privatisation. Each village was done generally separately. And quite a lot of the time, there were riots around the country because of this. So, for example, when an enclosure notice was nailed to the door of the parish church, I always remember reading, I think it was Otmore in Oxford, the rumour went around that the guy was coming from London to put the enclosure notice on the church, and the whole parish came out, hundreds of people, to stop the guy getting to the door so he couldn't nail the notice to the door. And this was people who were very connected with the land, as our family farmers are today, very connected with the land. And the benefit of that is that you look after it. You know your children's 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 children may be farming that land in 200 years' time. And so you take great care of it. This is the same attitude as the Native Americans had to land, which was, we really are going to care for this. And this is true environmentalism.
Well, I'm fascinated by at least five or six things that you said within that opening burst. But I'm going to park the conspiracy theory to the side, because this issue of land theft is fundamental, I think, to us today. First of all, as we speak, somewhere in the world, farmers are out protesting. I know this because in London, we've got them doing it at the moment because of some taxes to around inheritance. Inheritance, which have come something like 20% they want to tax them. But that's kind of the tip of the iceberg in terms of how farmers have been undermined. The relationship of farmers, food, land to ordinary people is underestimated. I think people generally just think of potatoes or vegetables or maybe cows and things. But farmers, it does seem, are now at such a pivotal point in terms of an overall policy, which I've seen developing from many, many establishments, but I would say the neoliberal elites have been at the heart of it. And the policies are Agenda 2030 linked. They're linked to urbanisation. They're linked to many 15-minute city concepts. They're linked to how food is produced. They're linked to the prices on houses that we have or don't have. What kind of food is grown? It's linked to the GMO. It's linked to big agriculture. It's linked to corporate outfits buying up huge swathes of land, definitely in America. We've seen the likes of BlackRock. It links into the fact that banks came in and took over even properties. Most properties in this nation, which were previously building society run, became bank kind of rolled, if you like. What was all this about? I mean, these were steady policies, certainly since Thatcher's years, which have accelerated here in Britain. And around the world, I know, for instance, that in India, the farmers shut down Delhi. And they had a huge outcry when corporations wanted to come in and take out that land and basically take away, essentially, people's ability to have small holdings, essentially. Why would they want to do that? You started with the history, which is really important because you've kind of contextualized it. It's almost like the next stage of saying, actually, we the transnational corporations or the state want to control all food supplies. That in itself just scares the hell out of me, because the idea that a set of very rich, wealthy and elitist folk should have have us by the collar in terms of food supply and food production is awfully dangerous, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, look, if you go to a supermarket, you'll see the meat nicely packaged in a little styrofoam you know, the idea is to separate people completely from the process that's bringing the food to them. Mm. So you're not thinking about the slaughterhouse. You know, there is all sorts of ways of just getting people not to think about how food and just to accept the price. Also, it's very oligopolistic. The supermarkets all work together, as we've seen over the last few years, all putting prices up together and using it, their monopoly, oligopoly, for the benefit of the shareholders rather than either the consumers or the farmers who are supplying much of the food. The supermarkets don't care if the food comes halfway across the world. All they care about is the price of it. And so we're being distanced from the land and from the production of the food that, you know, in a way it makes the people who have got allotments almost kind of potential revolutionaries. And, you know, that actually, when I was growing up in the 1960s, we used to get food from market gardens. We'd stop near Croydon. There were several along there, and you'd stop in. And these are like little small holdings where you would just buy the food directly off the people who were growing it. The farms in those days, we used to get milk from the local dairy farm, straight from the untreated milk. Now this is seen as something that is not under control. And I think what we're witnessing, particularly with the attack on livestock farmers, the sheep and the cattle, is, well, everything about farming is pretty much controlled apart from the cattle and the sheep farmers who own their own land and they're breeding and growing those animals on their farms. It's not controlled. If you look at other forms of farming, whether it's the arable, the wheat and all this, and as well as even chickens, the feed for those is all controlled by a tiny number of big corporations. And so, in a way, the livestock farmers are the last bastion of real farmers who can actually produce their own material from the land. In some of the farming literature I remember reading, I think it was one of John Seymour's books, where he did a little stint on a 150-acre farm in Essex, which was all horses, used horses. And this is back, I think, in the 1950s, maybe. And that farm had no inputs at all. Everything was coming off the land. So they were using the manure as fertilizer from the animals. It was a mixed farm. And they, for a long time, they had no electricity on the farm. They didn't use any diesel, of course, because you've just got horses and the horses are eating the grass from the farm itself. So the land is the source of all wealth. And when this revolution, so-called, happened in the Second World War, where so many of the labourers that had been working on the farms and the horses were all gotten rid of and replaced with tractors, it became a kind of demand industry. And so I think what we're looking at now is, where industrial agriculture has begun to take over, which is why it's so horrifying to see the farmers being put in the position where they are being treated worse than a corporation or a trust that owns the land. At the protest in Westminster, one of the most recent ones, one of the farmers was saying, well, next door to me is a holding of several thousand acres, but they won't be paying the inheritance tax because this is now a corporation, which is they've offshored. So the profits made on that farm will be hardly taxed because it's in an offshore business. So these are the people that really need to be tackled. And those profits need to be taxed. And also, of course, the supermarkets need to be properly taxed for the excessive profits that they're making. But then there's also this whole concept of security of tenure. This is absolutely key and it's hardly ever talked about. Is someone going to kick you off your land? Well, this is what's annoying the farmers. It looks as if they won't be able to afford to pay these taxes. And so they may have to sell land and they'll be slowly driven down into unprofitability. So they know that this is an attack on them. We need to give everybody, I think, basic security of tenure. What I'd love to see, and there are various campaigners agree that this is a really important, is to just abolish eviction. We're not evicting anybody. Give you the security to stay where you are. You will then look after that property. You won't let it fall to rack and ruin because you know it will be kicked out at some point. Mm. And if you can do that, what you've done is you've then guaranteed a right to somewhere to live. Now, I don't think that's beyond the possibility. And of course, back in medieval times, people understood this. We had in those days not a freehold or leasehold, as most people are under leasehold nowadays. They had a thing called a copyhold, which you just passed down in through the family. You stayed in that cottage. You were guaranteed you could stay there. But nowadays, we have massive insecurity in people's security, so-called, of tenure. So if you're renting somewhere, even if you've got a mortgage, something happens in your job, something happens to your income. Within a few weeks, suddenly the red notices are coming through the door and you're being told to leave. This is no way to run a country. It's no way to run a city. We want to make sure that people are secure in their living standards and where they live. So this is how you've obviously got all this stuff going on in the countryside, but this is a key issue, I think, anyway, in the cities too.
Well, I think the attack on family is something that I'm going to deal with in another program. But the attack on food, and the attack on production of food, the attack on land, is something that really does need urgent attention. Because if we don't get to grips with what the agenda is of the establishment, because the days after Keir Starmer welcomed in, I think it was Bill Gates and his BlackRock friend, Larry Fink.
Yes,
this was
not
so long ago, a few weeks ago.
That's right. No, it was just before Christmas. Rachel Rees is in there smiling, shaking their hands as well. It was just after they'd announced this inheritance.
Yeah, and then both of them are very hugely invested in property around the world, from the whole globe. So it was a bit suspicious that very soon after that, Keir Starmer went on the offensive with his Farmers Inheritance Acts and started to disrupt that scene. My issue really with it is that aside from the farmers' welfare themselves, this shift from an agricultural society to an industrial one clearly happened a couple of hundred years ago. It had manifestly good and bad impacts, but certainly it changed the lifestyle of Britain in a huge way. And I don't think it's all for the good. Today, we're facing a world where AI and the digital revolution is coming. It has arrived, actually. Robots, I can see a lot of the jobs that we thought were even safe within an industrial environment are now going to go, just as the agricultural jobs went when industry came in. So we're obviously going through a phase where something is being engineered, society is being engineered in a direction, but it doesn't seem as though people are being engaged or involved in the process of whatever that new lifestyle is. What's going on, Tony?
Well, the idea is that no one is going to be consulted about this. I think we had a summit, didn't we, with J.D. Vance, the vice president, coming over from the US to Paris, and Ursula von der Leyen, the president of Europe, telling us about how AI was just about to take off and we were going to deregulate it. But look, the idea here is that the super wealthy want this change because they control this technology now. I mean, look at the likes of Google, the other platforms like Apple, there's a whole list of them, Facebook, many of them funded, by the way, by Peter Thiel and his Bilderberg steering committee crew. I mean, I should, as a sidebar, say something about the Bilderbergers because I've done a lot of work on them over the years. This was a conference created after World War II in the same town as this Battle of Arnhem took place, which was a crucial battle in the war because it gave the Nazis extra time in order to squirrel their wealth away around the world to recrudesce in the Fourth Reich via Martin Bormann over in South America, creating 750 corporations and actually putting Jewish people in charge of those corporations to disguise the fact that it was Nazi money in them. So that's a book by Paul Manning, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. So the point is, here is that the whole change that happened because of the Bilderbergers were chaired in the first 10 years of their 20 years actually by a former SS officer, and this is the idea was, I think, to steer politics within the Western world. And you can see many of the politicians, Blair, Clinton, etc., made their first appearance at a Bilderberg conference, and then suddenly a few years later they made it into Prime Minister or President. So this is a sort of committee by which people are kind of, it's almost like a horse fair where you're looking at the teeth of the new person that you want to be in charge and, you know, sizing them up a little bit. So that was, I think, the Bilderberger's role. Kissinger was a major figure in Bilderberg. Peter Thiel is now a major figure at Bilderberg. But they are, I think, trying to engineer effectively a kind of soft fascism where big corporations are really in charge and all the politicians were pretty much done. That, I think, is the world we're living in now. So these, what Thiel has been funding over the years are things like Facebook. PayPal, obviously, is massively powerful nowadays. But the vision that they've got is a vision for a world where democracy is replaced by the technology they control. And AI, as they bring this sort of... what we've got here is where even with its politicians or whether it's soldiers on the battlefield, they have a problem because people sometimes say what they think and they've got a conscience. So the idea is to extract that from the equation and to replace it with a computer decision that has got no morals. So whether it's your lavender AI used to in the genocide of Palestinians, whether it's Palantir, which has been being used over in the war in Ukraine against the Russians. And I think to a certain extent, this is one of the major roles of the provocation of the Russians that happens, as happened in Ukraine, is to try out this technology. Let's see how many Russians we can kill. So that's the world, I think, that they're going toward.
We can see quickly how conversations like this start covering a lot of ground. I mean, we're talking about the theft of the commons, and we've focused on farmers as one aspect of the problem that's going on, the harassment of farmers, the theft of their land. But very quickly, we see that those who are doing it have got an interconnection with virtually every aspect of our lives, which makes it extremely necessary to understand that context. But I'm going to rein us back in to the theft of the commons element and say, well, of course, on the commons, if I was in South Africa, then that includes the diamond mines. It includes the gold mines. On that commons, in that land, also includes water. It includes, you know, virtually everything that is of any value. And so essentially, when we talk about the theft of the commons, we're talking about the wealth, the global wealth. And it seems as though, number one, 97%, for instance, of the land here in Britain is not urban, it's still rural. Cities are built largely on 3 or 4%. So there's an awful lot of land out there, still owned by 70% of the aristocracy. The Queen and the Church also own considerable amounts. So, but within the aristocracy, I would also say these corporations, etc., have a holding as well. But again, people never focus on who owns all this land, how they got it, what right they have towards having it, and why it's not necessarily distributed more evenly so that people could perhaps be able to make a living out from it. Because clearly, food prices are now going up, and they're going up for a reason. And we're told that it's food corporations that can produce things on the other side of the world, for instance, and then ship them in. And often they'll be cheaper than our local farmer who's producing potatoes locally or producing something else, whatever that may be, which is probably at three times the price. Go try and buy any organic food and you'll have to pay three times the price to get anywhere near it. And that ordinary person can't afford that. So this is really significant that whatever's being done is not, it's not helping the ordinary person. He's having to eat substandard processed food. Sugar is an example, white sugar, processed. You know, it's virtually leftovers. But we get it pumped into virtually as much of our food as I can think of, which people like to binge on. There's a real problem here because it's impacting our health as well as the livelihoods that we've talked about in terms of farmers. And so what's your overview of that impact, that area in terms of health and the impact of the theft of the commons?
Well, look, health isn't really my subject, but health, the health of the nation in terms of physical health. I mean, this is part of the alienation, I think, from, I mean, even if you say, for example, you go to France, you'll find that the culture there is very much people are in touch with the countryside around them. In Russia, I was over there in 2014, and there were whole bunches of people from the town going off into the countryside to collect mushrooms. You don't really get that here in Britain at all, because we've lived under this urbanisation for such a long time. And actually, for a period after the Second World War, there was an enormous increase in people's home ownership, individual home ownership. So people felt quite happy in their home with their garden, maybe with their allotment, and maybe with the price of food and the quality of food being reasonably good. But slowly but surely, just like with the rent, the price of food, the screws are being turned down. So what happens in a post-industrial economy like Britain, it seems to me, is that the people who want the wealth, they can't make anything anymore because it's all being made in China. So what they do is they look at the infrastructure of the country. So the basic things that people need, those human rights, the right to water, the right to shelter, the right to work, for example, right to a job, all these basic human rights, they are now controlled by corporations. So we have an absolute crisis in water, for example. How insane is it to have privatised water, to turn that over to shareholder profit? They haven't done it in Scotland, by the way. Scotland's water is still all in national hands. So the idea, it seems to me, is to all of the basics in life that you need is to let's just turn up the screws on that, and we'll drive the entire urban population slowly but surely into poverty. And look what you were saying about the pattern of land ownership. So much of our land ownership is a feudal system you're describing, really. Mm. And so much of the land, which is owned by these big feudal landowners, they've had, like the Duke of Westminster, that most of his land he's never walked on, maybe never seen, because he's such a massive landowner. Of course, they own big slices of property in central London as well. So this has been there since, they've had that land since many of them since the Norman Conquest. And there's been no thought about it. Now, actually, in a way, I'm not against feudal land ownership, because a feudal landowner on a reasonably small scale has a relationship with the people that live on the land direct, and he has to pass them in the street. You know, so they also run feudal estates, and many of these little villages are totally feudally owned, and they look after those people who don't pay much rent. It's almost like a kind of modern council housing or housing association. But the real problem with these big landowners now is that they get massive amounts of revenue, and as the subsidies are going down now, but they've traditionally, like the Crown, have had some of the biggest of all of the farm subsidies has been going to these big landowners. It would be very simple for the EU and for the British government now to just put a cap on that and say, well, look, if you own, you can claim farm subsidy for, say, 1,000 acres, but no more. I mean, what they probably do is to split it up into lots of individual companies or something and try and make out that it was, do you know what I mean? But that the economies of scale are all about concentration of power. So the smaller people and the medium farmers are finding it much more difficult. The big ones who've offshored their profits are finding it much easier. And so everything is being centralised, power is being... And you know what? This is a very dangerous route that we're going... It's a fascist route we're going down. Centralisation of power and corporate power, the denuding of... If you think about now, we live in a financialised economy, right, which is... Finance capitalism rules. So money now buys political parties. Money buys television stations, radio stations. I mean, I'm in the National Union of Journalists, but journalists don't run transmitters. They don't have their own transmitters. Journalists don't have their own printing presses, sadly. I mean, in the old days, actually, before Wapping and Rupert Murdoch, the big battle in the 1980s, the journalists had a very good relationship with the printers. So the journalists union and the printing union. So when a journalist did a story, he would go and stand, or she would go and stand down next to the printer. The printer would show the journalist the story on the metal, hot metal that had been put onto the printing machine. And the journalist would read it backwards and sign a bit of paper saying, yes, that's my story. So there was, it was much more difficult for the proprietor or an editor to interfere. Now you press a button and it goes off and you've no idea what's going to be in the newspaper. If I can just use one example, if that's okay. During the 7/7 London bombings, the journalist for The Guardian, Mark Honingsbaum, I think was his name, did an article the day after the bombings. But on the day of the bombings, he did a report explaining, it was a voice report from Marks and Spencer's, I think it was the Edgware Road. He was talking to the people who come out of the station, out of the tube tunnels, many of them injured, certainly traumatised after a bomb had gone off on their train. They'd been brought along the tracks. So he was chatting with those people and he did a voice report where twice in that voice report, he said the bombs are under the trains. Now, this is not part of the official narrative. But anyway, that was on the day he said that. So in the next day's paper, an article came out saying the bombs were inside the trains. So a few weeks later, I phoned him up at The Guardian. I said, Mark, how come on the day you're saying the bombs are under the trains? And actually, in your article, it says, he said, well, all I can say is when I submit my copy, I don't control what goes out in the next day's paper. So that relationship between printer and journalist is gone.
And the relationship between the feudal or the landlord and his people, the old day, the serfs, peasants, whatever we want to call them, the reality is they had about 150 days off, more days off than people have today, and they had a very fixed system, village life. In terms of, you know, modern medication, of course, that wasn't there necessarily. But nonetheless, their local lifestyle created community. I'm not sure about the impacts. Again, I was talking about health. I'm not sure about what the impact was on people's happiness, their sense of depression. Look at cities today and look at the emptying of the countryside, or the lack of jobs on that front, is pushing people into cities where I would argue that health has in many ways declined.
Well, we've got a challenge on, haven't we? We've got a challenge on. Britain possibly could lead the way into post-urban society with a sort of back-to-the-land movement. But you see, BlackRock has other plans. And that seems to me to be the main instigator of the current inheritance tax. The idea, very simple idea, that if you're going to inherit land, we're going to tax you. But if you're on a business that is bought this land and using it for your shareholders, we won't tax you. At least because you can just replace people on the board. Someone dies, you replace somebody on the board. You don't pay any tax because it's a business. But if you're going to keep it as a family affair, we will tax you. Of course, as you said, it's like the break, partly but to do with the breakup of the family. So I think the idea, it seems to me, is to alienate everyone by putting them in little boxes. And I'm talking about like separating the printer from the journalist. You're separating the person from the growing of the food. You're separating the person from the land. So you're someone that's sort of hovering above the land and you've got no actual connection with it. Do you know one thing in Kevin Cahill's excellent book, Who Owns Britain? Kevin used to work for the Sunday Times Rich List as their deputy editor, and his speciality was looking at people's land holdings because they often hid their wealth in land. Plenty to say about Kevin, but one of the things he discovered was that the royal family had put the screws onto the Murdoch Empire and managed to get lots of their wealth taken out of the rich list, so they come right down. Of course, the Rothschild family did the same. I remember you never see adverts for Rothschild wine, but in the Sunday Times Rich List a few years ago in the magazine, the Sunday Times magazine, there's a whole thing about the Rich List. So on the first page of Who's on the Rich List, there's an advert for Rothschild wine because they are also, of course, incredibly wealthy. But what Kevin uncovered was that we don't really own the land. Legally, the land is all owned by the Crown. And even if you've got a freehold, you have that freehold from the Crown. And so if that land needs to be taken away from you, you'll just be told, sorry, it's go through the court if necessary. If you want to try and take it to court, you'll lose it. So it's not actually your land. But in his, he's done another book called Who Owns the World. which is a really, you know, sort of, he's done a Who Owns Ireland as well, actually, because he's Irish, Kevin Cahill.
Right. Right.
And in Who Owns the World, he explains which countries actually do give you ownership of the land. One of them is Russia. You actually own that land. And if someone wants to take it off you, they're going to have to compensate you until you get to the point where you go, okay, you can have it. But you can't do that in many other countries. So I think this understanding of who, I mean, in his book, he goes through these various feudal estates and who owns what around the country. But we need a vision for redistribution of land in the countryside, at least to give people the right to, I mean, even something like in Bristol right now, we've got 1,000 or more people living in caravans because they can't afford to pay the rent. And it's a massive, seen as a problem, but it's just a result of a policy which is just a financialized.
Well, I think I'm glad you brought it back to the urban, because we've dealt with the countryside and
but those
land.
People need somewhere permanent. I mean, I talk about something like to start with, drive-in allotments. Why not, you know, if someone is in a vehicle, they can go in, they can, you know, have a small holding there, and then if they want to, they can go off around the festival circuit in the summer. But they have security of tenure on that spot. And that, to me, is a very simple thing that could be done. Because it's easy to rail against the darkness. We need to also shine a candle and shine a light to say this is a
way
good
forward.
Way forward. Mm. People enjoy growing their own food. They get a satisfaction from it. They also don't want to be buying this mass-produced muck from many of the supermarkets are giving us nowadays. And I mean, I would say we should only have organic food. If we've got a well-regulated system, let's only have healthy food. Let's not have unhealthy food. Make it all healthy and drive the overheads down. Because if you talk to farmers, what they'll tell you is that the overheads have gone through the roof. They're now sort of talking about fertilizer taxes, the cost of electricity. Obviously, this isn't too much if you're just growing wheat or raising cattle. You don't use much electricity, but lots of farming practices do. And where they do use electricity, they're paying 3 or 4 times what they were a few years ago for that as well. So their overheads need to come right down. We want to help these people. If you think about it, it's insane to take on farmers. Absolutely insane. This is 2,000 years, 3,000, 4,000 years of history here. This is how we started to get stable, civilized societies, by having a surplus in food. And that's why for such a long time, farmers have been known to be so important. You provide a surplus of food, you can have the rest of society can start to thrive in the cities, etc.
Well, you've certainly made a great case for starting to create an alternative way of thinking, lifestyle, and how we should maybe construct society beyond just being corralled into some kind of AI universal credit mechanism where we're paid to be redundant
and
do nothing.
Well, that's where they're trying to take us, isn't it?
We're going to be paid to be virtual humans, in a way, entertain us, keep us off the kind of the thinking too much range, and keep us away from any of the commons. That does seem like a very dystopian kind of Brave New World. But focusing a little bit more on the urban side of it, people can't afford housing. They simply can't in this country and in most urban environments. So we're being crammed into urban environments, but we're being priced out of being able to ever afford them. There's no such thing as, I mean, I'm not a great advocate of the mortgage, the death grip of the mortgage, as it's known. But nonetheless, at least they gave some incentives for somebody to work their life, build a family, have a home, and be able to also perhaps do something for their kids. That's all most people really want, to be fair. But even that seems to be taken away now, because children are now being forced back to live in maybe very small accommodations with their parents. Not an entirely bad thing, because I'm a great advocate for family and for community and for building that. But at the same time, it does seem as though it's being still done at the expense of greater wealth for the very, very wealthy. And I think that people like Keir Starmer, for instance, if they're really serious. And he has said he's going to be building houses. But I mean, who's that going to actually benefit? What's the price going to be? Are they going to continue overpricing housing by maybe having laundered money coming into the city of London, which then gets those people investing in properties in London and making the prices so exorbitant that a local Britisher can't even afford them? It's usually just empty houses lining up in Knightsbridge now in Kensington with foreign investors, multi-zillionaire investors with empty properties maybe, or even rented out, I don't know. But it doesn't seem like there's a balance even now, even in the housing market. They're not going to build an amount of houses which would depress the housing market, which is what was probably necessary to bring the houses prices. What are the solutions to that?
Well, look, the housing market, I mean, you talk to any honest economist will tell you that you have to make sure the property market stays stable, because the whole of the rest of the economy rests on that.
Yeah, sure.
If it starts to go down, oh, everything else, there's... But hang on a minute, because this is good for people. This is why growth is so insane.
Yeah.
If the housing market's going down and people are paying less rent, then that's negative growth. That's good for the people because they're paying less rent. You know, so there's a sort of religion around growth, which is just nonsense. But in the wider terms with housing, the idea is, I think, to drive people into debt and into the debt trap. You know, the financial sector wants control of these people. It wants instability, because people who are in an unstable housing situation will compromise their values to take on jobs, work, managers that, you know, they might not otherwise do. And it creates a bad working environment. If you're prepared to do absolutely anything to pay that mortgage, then you'll possibly discard your morals during your work life.
So building social housing seems to be the way forward on that. One other area...
The people who are building these houses, it's really important. This is not the government doing this. This is an artificially inflated market from all sorts of reasons. Actually, I was reading recently in the Financial Times about the London property market. These big skyscrapers, are almost all of them, are borrowed against. And the trouble is that they're not necessarily worth the money that they borrowed against. So if you wanted to actually sell it, you might not get what it says on the books that it's worth for it. So you have a bubble, a very dangerous bubble in commercial property, but also they've had to pump up this private housing market too. So the individual house builders can make a fortune. So it's those people, the individual house building companies, that are making all this, they're going to build these houses, so-called for the government. They're not council houses or anything like that. And they are going to be making the money. But you know what keeps this market buoyant, is the 750,000 people or so coming into Britain every year. Now, this is students, this is on visas, it's not just on small boats. Mm. But this, to me, is why no government is ever going to stop the mass migration. It's because it keeps this bubble pumping up and pumping up with this massive demand for housing. And so they're talking about building houses, this new Starmer government, aren't they? But is that going to be, are any of those people in those caravans, the thousands of caravans, going to be able to afford these? No, of course not. They talk about it as affordable housing. Yeah. What a joke. It's totally not affordable. So I think we need to have a government that actually looks for people, looks out for people. And if we did have one, then of course people would embrace it. And you know what, Jeremy Corbyn, in his era, he was actually that kind of socialist, that sort of Labour person who was putting a vision out which was about people. He was pro-Palestinian. He's looking at what's going on over in the Middle East and saying, this is not on. We can't have this sort of apartheid oppression, which is now turned into a genocide because it's been left. And Corbyn was shut out, completely shut out of the political process in several ways. Very important to understand the bomb attacks that happened in Manchester, or the bomb at the Manchester Arena bombing in the run-up to that election where Corbyn nearly won. And then we had the Westminster bomb attack. A guy drove a car into the fence of the parliament. That was another. And then we had the London Bridge stabbings. There were these these attacks, which I believe were orchestrated. In fact, the people who did them were all reported to MI5 in the previous months on their terror hotline saying, watch out for this guy. And so then they go and do an attack. So I think, and then they, of course, the press in the few days before the general election had all these pictures of Jeremy Corbyn talking with the terrorists after we'd had these terror attacks.
But the other thing,
he was also shut out by the party, the Labour Party itself. The Ford report conclusively proved that the people working within the Labour Party wanted him to lose the election. They were throwing important bits of paper in the bin. They were helping Corbyn's opponents.
Well,
and so
Corbynism definitely was bringing a change, which probably wasn't to the benefit of, again, the neoliberal capitalist leaders. But what I want to focus on one other area.
So that's how this vision has been shut out, is what I'm saying.
Got it. And as far as land goes, the other glaring problem that I see is we've had Extinction Rebellion, we've had the climate change narrative, net zero has been shoved down our throats, you know, we've got to kill the carbon, get rid of the cows because they're farting too much, even human beings have to be depopulated because
The great saviour is the small modular reactors, which don't actually exist and there's no funding for. But these are just visions put out there by the government now. It seems to me we've just got PR. But we don't have any real action at all.
But linking it to this business of the theft of the commons, I don't see any of these movements in a big way saying, look, let's deal with the deforestation or the Amazon. I don't see, like, the real environmental, actions that need to be taken seem to have been gone by the wayside. And all we hear is that there's too much CO2. Well, plant some trees. Surely, I'm not Einstein, but if you planted some trees, they tend to suck up CO2 and they tend to give oxygen, which is a pretty good direction. But I don't see any policies for planting billions of trees. I see the opposite. I see still the size of, I don't know, whales or something being cut down in the Amazon jungle and various other places. So it seems as though we're being sold something else a little bit putrefied in terms of the package, i.e. this kind of focus on land and the commons and saving it, but somehow doing it through this other business of the climate change narrative, and there's no talk of the real environmental
issues. Well, we've got wood chips and biofuel, right? This is there was a fantastic film called The Planet of the Humans, made by Jeff Gibb, I think it was, and Michael Moore a few years ago, and this shows that the so-called net zero policies are a total and utter disaster. The idea of burning forests in power stations. This is what we're now doing at Drax. The old, I actually tried to visit Drax. I wrote to them and said, you're doing tours. Can I come and visit? And they told me the days of the tours. I turned up and it was like the mafia were running Drax at the entrance. It was like these thugs trying to protect this power station, because what they're doing is they're feeding in forests into this power station now, and the same sort of thing is going on in Scotland. And you know what? All of these power stations, the conversion to this is all subsidised. This is the companies doing this are doing it on welfare benefits. So in Scotland now, there was a massive crisis because they decided they're going to build all these new biofuel wood chip power stations in Scotland, and the timber industry in Scotland said, "My God, you can't do this. You're going to destroy the market for timber. We have using wood for building houses and this all this sort of thing. You're going to be feeding so much into these new power stations that there's going to be no timber left, and we can't actually grow enough timber to feed these power stations in Scotland." So do you know what they did? They said, "Okay, right. Well, before we open the power stations, we will ship all this timber in from America." So this is this vision of a so-called net zero future. And actually, even The Guardian has reported recently that the biggest CO2 emitter in Britain was Drax Power Station, this so-called vision.
Well, I know it's mixed up. The industrial military complex is the biggest purveyor of carbon, you know, emissions, but nobody's going to be stopping the sale of military weapons that the Americans and others are doing.
But what I'm saying is it's not supposed to make sense. If you start to, this is George Orwell, if you start to interrogate the net zero agenda, none of it makes sense. The idea that you're going to I think it's in it, British Rail, who still use diesels, have to pay carbon offset money for it. And so the companies that run the carbon offset market are buying up farmland so the local farmers can't afford to buy it. And they're squeezing farmers off the land by buying this land to build, to put trees on. This is the total failure of net zero.
And I can't.
It's marketizing it. Trying to turn it into a market is beyond a joke. It's not working at all.
I can't help but also point out that the solution they're offering is this world where we don't have to use fossil fuels, because they're so bad and they're destroying the environment, apparently. But you've got these guys saying lithium is okay. So going into the theft of the land theme, you know, you've got the pollution that comes with that, the raping of the land and the destruction of environments going on. But nobody's shouting about Elon Musk's need for lithium, and he's pronouncing a lot of things about what the world should and shouldn't be doing, and yet his own hypocrisy seems manifest in terms of selling us this vision of a fossil free energy scenario that we're supposed to buy into, yet it's causing huge damage already. You know, where do we go with that?
Well, look, this I think is one of the signs that we're living in a fascist society, is that these things do not make sense. If you try to rationalize them, there is no rationality in Drax and burning forests in order to save the planet. It doesn't work. Look at, say, for example, something like Ukraine. We're told that we've got to do something about the Russians. Putin is a dictator. Well, no, he's not. He's far more popular than any of our leaders. He's not a dictator at all.
No, Ukraine was the granary of Europe, in fact.
Yeah, and look what happened when they tinkered with the farming in Ukraine. They had one of the worst famines the world's ever seen. It's not supposed to make sense, and this is a good sign that things are very badly wrong. Why would you want to provoke a nuclear-armed state? Why on earth would you do that? Henry Kissinger, I think, understood right the way through the Cold War, no, you've got to deal with these people. But they're saying nowadays, oh, no, it doesn't matter. We don't need to deal with them. We'll fire a few rockets into Russia, missiles, and see if they might, I suppose they might fire back.
Isn't part of the imperialist plunder manifesto controlling land? And if you can, Syria, as an example, they took over those chunks of Syria very immediately where there was oil, and they made sure they kept hold of that. That was the Americans,
Black Rock are in Ukraine. Yeah, they've been taking over loads of the land in Ukraine.
So it seems as though a lot of the disastrous forever wars, a lot of the conflict, a lot of the chaos is created precisely, I would argue, because they want the land. They want to control all of the land, not just take it from farmers, but also take it from other states.
Isn't the land actually a means to an end, like money can be a means to an end? It's about power, really. And I think the idea is that if you take the land, you don't necessarily want it yourself, but you want other people to be deprived of it. And you want families to be deprived of the ability to make a living, because then they're more dependent on your money system. You know, imagine if, you know, my farm I was talking about earlier, the 150-acre farm, where you have no inputs. You don't need anything. You've got men, women, families, horses, and you're producing masses of food out of that, off of that land. If you can take that land away, those people need to come to you and beg for their food. Well, they need to come to you and beg for their accommodation.
Well, Tony, we've covered a lot of ground. I still didn't do it fully, and you kept trying to steer me towards solutions. We didn't really get into the solutions, but you posited a few.
Redistribution of land, absolutely key. Britain has got something like 55, 60,000 acres of land, and we've got around about the same number of people. It seems to me everybody needs to have an acre, and they need to be told, like they are in Russia, that's yours. And if the government seems to be being weaponized against the people, they should be there to serve the people, to serve the interests of the people, but governments all around the West have been weaponized against them. And we were talking a bit about privatization of utilities, but they don't do that in many other parts of the world. And that, it seems to me, is one of the massive fights that's going on the border of Ukraine with Iran and countries like that, is that you've got a finance capitalism here in this part of the world. Michael Hudson talks about this, The Economist. Finance capitalism here is taking on the old school industrial capitalism, where people vote and their government controls the infrastructure. Here, now, everything's up for grabs. As I was saying, you know, your financial people can buy your political parties, they can buy your media. They don't do that in Russia. If they try and buy the Kremlin out, the Kremlin will chop their legs off.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for a wonderful journey across this very, very important, very fascinating topic. We've tried our best to be able to really summarise the broad range of factors which you should be really, really concerned about, and things that you should arguably become active in terms of changing within your own particular nations, wherever you happen to be. Land is fundamental. Control of the land by the people, having some sort of control in it, is absolutely fundamental. Giving away that land is probably the worst thing that you can do in terms of your own liberty, your freedom, even your food supplies, your health. It touches every aspect of human existence on this planet.
And never forget, the land is a free gift to mankind. It's not actually ownable in the same way as, say, your car or this glass is ownable by somebody. It's a common treasury for all, as Gerard Winstanley the Digger said in the English Civil War.
No more to be said from me. Please like, share, subscribe to this channel, and we'll bring you more eye-opening conversations with solutions as well to hopefully steer our world in a better direction. Thank you for watching this edition of The Deep Dive Perspective.